Race, Corruption, and the Fight for Justice, a New York story.
The corruption that had grown up over the decades was very deeply connected to the racial attitudes. And this was the rot, this was the moral rot that was at the core of the relationship between the law enforcement and the black community in the city. And this was the tinderbox that had been festering for years and was bound to explode.
That's author T.J. English. We'll spend the hour talking with him about his new book, The Savage City. It's out this week from HarperCollins. That's our show today on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first talked with T.J. English in 2009 about his bestseller, Havana Nocturne. That book explored how the mob took over in pre-revolutionary Cuba. His new book, The Savage City, has the same streetwise feel, part thriller, part social history. It takes the reader back to a dark decade of violence and chaos in New York City from the early 60s to the 70s. T.J. English interweaves three iconic stories about a corrupt cop, a militant Black Panther, and an innocent young black man framed by the NYPD for the brutal and sensational murder of two young white women in Manhattan. He uses these three stories to examine how racism, official corruption, and the dreams of an oppressed community for justice come together in an explosive mixture that changed America's greatest city forever. T.J. English has written about crime and criminal justice for Esquire, Playboy, New York, The Village Voice, The L.A. Times, and The New York Times. He's also the author of Paddywhacked and Born to Kill. T.J. English, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be here.
This terrific book, The Savage City, Race, Murder, and a Generation on the Edge, this takes place in a time in New York. I remember that time in New York. As a matter of fact, I was a young teenager. And it was a time of great racial transition and tension. Paint a little picture for us. I know it's a very elaborate, actually, picture. There's a lot of things that are going on there. But if you could just kind of sketch the outlines for us of what was happening in New York at that time.
Well, this is the era that people are usually referring to when they talk about New York City and in its most violent days, most dangerous days. In fact, you hear a lot about this era mostly from New Yorkers who left New York City during this period and are now living in Phoenix or Seattle or the Bay Area in California, because this era, this 10-year period from the early 60s into the early 70s, was an incredibly frightening period for a lot of New Yorkers, particularly families that had been here for a few generations and weren't ready for what was to take place over this 10-year period. Really what it was, if you were to trace the roots of it, which I'd lay out right in the introduction to the book, is way down in the state of Mississippi, a long ways away from New York, the mechanical cotton picker was invented and put into use, and it created this migration, this huge migration that's been written about a lot and commented about a lot, of Southern blacks, sharecroppers, who were suddenly found themselves out of any foreseeable source of employment, and they started heading north. They started heading all over the United States, but particularly to the northern industrial cities, places like Baltimore and Chicago and Philadelphia and New York City, and most especially New York City, because New York City had Harlem, and Harlem was a beacon for a lot of African Americans who were coming north and looking for a place to settle. But the numbers were so vast and so sudden. I mean, it really started to happen within just a few years, starting primarily in the post-war years, the late 40s, but all throughout the 50s. You know, you had this huge wave of poor Southern blacks coming to the cities. And there was the numbers were too great to be contained just within the boundaries of Harlem. They wound up settling on the fringe of white working class neighborhoods in Brooklyn and the Bronx and all over the city. And it created It created a kind of tension that was totally unexpected and unplanned for. It created this era of white flight when a lot of longstanding white ethnics, Italians, Jews, Irish, started to flee the city because of what they saw as poverty-ridden population coming into their neighborhoods, coming into their cities, creating crime. So there was this tension that happened. The older, longstanding residents feeling that they were under siege from this wave of migrants from the Deep South.
And standing between the old residents and the new residents was the police department. Many of these were guys who had come from these neighborhoods, were part of the white flight, but they went back there to work every day. What was their role?
Well, that really is the crux of the story. Because, you know, this is so important, and it's something it's an aspect of our history, our urban history in particular, American urban history, that really has not been addressed. And that is, I described the phenomenon of the migrants coming north and butting up against the longstanding white ethnic residents, and as you mentioned quite accurately, the police being the line in between these two communities. And so this created another kind of tension, which was, traditionally speaking, the way the police dealt with the black minority in the city of New York was quite simply through brute force. Keep them in their place. The blacks had Harlem. That's where they were supposed to live. Any black person that strayed from a circumscribed black neighborhood was considered to be a suspicious character and was dealt with oftentimes brutally, violently, swiftly, to say the least. And this was sort of the longstanding relationship between the black community and the police. My book begins in 1963, when you're getting to maybe the first generation of African Americans, perhaps children of the migrants who had come north, who are not as inclined to be cowed in the way that their earlier generation might have been when they first arrived. And so really this book deals with that first generation of African Americans in the cities who decided that they were not going to take this kind of treatment anymore. They were not going to take business as usual in terms of the relationship between black minorities and the police. They were inspired in many ways by the civil rights movement that in the early 60s was happening mostly down south, but they would hear stories through family relatives about what was taking place in Alabama and Mississippi. They would hear stories about Martin Luther King Jr. And in fact, you know, the book opens on the day in 1963 that Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech, which was sort of the seminal event that touched off this whole era of resistance. King, of course, was held to the philosophy of nonviolent resistance. But this new generation, this younger generation that was coming of age in the 60s, didn't necessarily adhere to the philosophy of nonviolence. They, in New York City in particular, they were more inclined to follow the philosophy and teachings of Malcolm X, a much more militant approach.
So this was a seminal event, not only in the era, but also in the book. In the book, The Savage City, T.J. English, you follow the stories of three people, three iconic people here. There was George Whitmore, who was a young black guy who gets framed for murders he doesn't commit. Bill Phillips, a crooked cop, and Daruba bin Wahad, who is becomes a Black Panther. Let's take George Whitmore, because where he gets drawn in is right around this time of King's speech.
Yeah, well, what we've been talking about is sort of really the framework for the story. So now let's get into the story, because it does begin on August 28, 1963, the day of the March on Washington. On that day, when tens of thousands of New Yorkers had gathered on buses and cars and trains and headed down to Washington, D.C. for the march, back in New York City, two young white women in their early 20s were brutally, viciously murdered in their apartments in the middle of the day on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, perhaps the safest neighborhood in the city, one of the most prosperous neighborhoods in the city. And it was really quite shocking. I mean, in 1963, that level of savage violence was not common. It unfortunately becomes common later in the 60s and the 70s, the kind of savage violence associated with drugs and the Vietnam era, perhaps. But in 63, you know, they were I won't go into too much detail, but they were disemboweled. One of the girls was raped, just about as horrific a crime as you could imagine. And so the city was shocked by it. And it was called the Career Girls Murders because these women were too young, working women in the city. They were roommates. And there was pressure on the police to find out who did this because, you know, the killer was still out there capable of doing it again. And the police, they were frustrated. They had, you know, it was a bloody crime scene, but they had, and this was the pre-DNA, you know, pre-sophisticated forensics era, and they just really didn't have that much to go on. And months went by, and the public was getting kind of freaked out because they didn't have any suspects or really any concrete clues. 6 months later, 6 or 7 months later, out in the borough of Brooklyn, about as far away from the crime scene as you can get and still be in the city of New York, police pull in a young black kid, George Whitmore Jr., 19-year-old black kid who's living with relatives in Brooklyn at the time. George had volunteered some information to a policeman on the street in Brooklyn one day, and they said, that's interesting, and they brought him back to the precinct. And by the time they got done with him, 24 hours later, they had gotten him to sign a 61-page confession, the longest confession in the history of the city of New York, confessing to a local sexual assault that had taken place in Brooklyn, to a murder that had taken place in Brooklyn just a few blocks away from the precinct, and more importantly, they got Whitmore to confess to the Career Girls, the most infamous, notorious crime in the city at the time, the Career Girls murders in Manhattan. And it was sensational. It was all over the front page of the newspapers that they caught the monster that had done the crime. But Whitmore was sort of a sweet, kind of soft 19-year-old kid, not terribly bright, didn't even see well. In fact, he was legally blind and went around without glasses, so he didn't see well. He was the easiest kid in the world to frame. I spent a lot of detail in the book describing that 24-hour period in the precinct where they break George down and how they get him to sign that confession. And in many ways, it was remarkably easy. They didn't really have to resort to much violence because George was pliable that way. And I think they knew that once they got him in there, that here was a kid that we could get to confess to the Lincoln assassination if we wanted to. And so it was kind of like pulling wings off a fly. And they got George to confess, and that began this saga. It would take George 10 years to get out from under this false prosecution for these crimes. And that 10 years is basically the framing device for the book.
Explain how these kinds of confessions can happen. I'm sure, you know, until I really read this part of your book, I couldn't understand how, no matter what, how anybody could confess to such horrific crimes without having done them. Now, part of it is that he didn't even know that these girls were dead.
Right. Well, they tricked him into it, but it wasn't difficult to trick him. You know, it happens way more often than you would like to imagine. I mean, it's a psychological thing to get someone to confess to crimes they didn't commit. It was, I think, particularly prevalent back in the era, this era of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. If a black kid or a Puerto Rican kid or any minority kid was brought into a police precinct, it was so easy to coerce them into confessing to some version of a crime. Police weren't examined. This was the pre-Watergate era. There was no tradition of investigative journalism. Police basically did what they want, and nobody paid much attention to it. They were rarely called into question on it by the press or even by people within the government or within the criminal justice system. So I think you often got situations where a young black kid might be brought into a precinct and told, we've got you on this murder charge. You know, you better either confess to this or confess to some smaller charge than the one we brought you in on. And they give the kid a court-appointed attorney someone who's part of the system, and that attorney tells them, look, you know, you better just cop a plea here and confess to some version of this crime, or you're going to get hit with the worst potential crime of all. And that's how this system operates. And in fact, that, what I just described, is still very common today. That's how charges are plead and negotiated in the within the system on a daily basis.
Because people assume that they really can't get a fair shake in court.
If you're poor and you can't afford an attorney of your own, and you're basically at the mercy of the court-appointed attorney, who is often part and parcel of the system of prosecution, particularly back in the early 60s, you know, with the Whitmore case, the first attorney that he was assigned happened to be a member of the same political club as the judge who he was brought before at his arraignment. And that judge, knowing that that attorney was a member of his political club, assigned him that case. That's how that attorney got that case. So the one hand washes the other philosophy, which was much more deeply ingrained in the system back then than it is now. But that's how you would get a poor person charged with a crime up against this giant wall that the system represented to them. And it's not hard to get them to cop a plea. It's not hard to get them to confess to something they didn't do.
And yet, in fact, this first attorney was a pretty decent guy in some ways, maybe not as skilled as he needed to be. He was young. He was able, however, to make this a cause célèbre because he did believe in the innocence of George Whitmore.
Well, the first attorney, and you know, this guy's still alive. I went down to Florida and found him and interviewed him. He was intimidated, I think, by the case. He was young, and this was a bigger case than anything that had ever been dropped in his lap. And he didn't want to deal with it as a race case because he was very much a product of the system, and you didn't buck the system, you know, you didn't make waves. So I think he missed the opportunity of seeing the Whitmore case within the historical sweep of the civil rights movement. Now, later attorneys, it's hard to keep up with all the attorneys that come through the Whitmore case over the course of the next 10 years because there's numerous trials and numerous prosecutions, convictions overturned, retried on the same charges. George goes through quite a number of lawyers. Eventually, the NAACP does become involved in the case, and the Whitmore case does become identified quite clearly as a civil rights issue and is treated that way within the system. But initially, you know, it was just the case of a 19-year-old black kid charged with these horrific crimes. That first attorney, I think, did suspect that George was innocent. And he represented George in the first case of a sexual assault in Brooklyn and lost that trial. So George was convicted of the very first trial that he had out in Brooklyn. So that lawyer was quickly removed from the case. But you know, it was tough. I mean, in many ways, the George Whitmore saga, the legal part of it, kind of redefined the system in a way because George was so persistent. He just said, "I'm innocent. Why would I say that I did what I didn't?" Once his confession was sort of exposed as a fraud, and it was exposed as a fraud fairly early on, he still had all these other charges against him. He was now within the system, and the system had a vested interest in trying to prove that George Whitmore was guilty of something, that they hadn't just snatched some innocent kid off the street and hit him with all these crimes. And George was dogged in his, and maybe even naive in just saying, I didn't do it. You know, I'm not going to cop a plea to some smaller charge. I didn't do it. And so he stayed strong, and he paid a very heavy price for it. But I think his saga in many ways did have a major impact on the system of judgment or the whole judicial system and the system of criminal justice in New York City.
Well, it actually had something to do with the Miranda decision.
Right. It was one of the cases that was cited in the Miranda decision, which was passed in 66, I believe. The Whitmore case was cited as a major case of why someone who'd been brought in and was being charged with a crime had a right to an attorney, had a right to remain silent, was not obligated to speak to police officers until an attorney was present. This was something new and unprecedented until 1966. That was the Supreme Court of Justice Warren's Supreme Court passed the Miranda decision. The Whitmore case was also very instrumental in getting the death penalty abolished in New York State. It was one of the cases that led to the abolishment of the death penalty in 1967. So I think in the book I describe the Whitmore case as a virus that once it got into the system, it was starting to have an effect on the system that nobody really had anticipated that it would.
We're talking with T.J. English about his terrific new book, The Savage City, Race, Murder, and a Generation on the Edge. So let's move now. I'm not sure where to go, to the cop or to the Black Panthers. But I think the cop first, Bill Phillips, a corrupt cop who was perhaps one of the most famous turncoat cops in the history of New York. Tell us who he is in the system that he thrived in.
Right. Well, the important thing about the Bill Phillips aspect of this story is you'll notice as you read it that it never directly intersects with the George Whitmore story. Bill Phillips is not one of the cops that becomes involved in the war against the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army. And I deliberately did not want to use a cop that was involved in that aspect, a reaction against the infusion of the militancy, the growing militancy of the Black population in New York, because there was an important point I wanted to make about corruption in the police department. Bill Phillips was a gleefully corrupt cop and was a gleefully corrupt cop from the day he came on the job, pretty much. His father had been a cop, and he'd grown up hearing stories about his father being a cop during Prohibition and about how the police were on the take during the Prohibition years. And ever since then, there'd been this philosophy in the police department of gaming the system, I guess you'd call it, finding ways of making money on the side, you know, by allowing criminal activity to take place and you getting a piece of it, by, you know, catching regular average citizens who had committed some sort of crime and getting a bribe from them to not charge them with the crime or to charge them with some much lower version of the crime or something like that. The hustle. Bill Phillips was a hustler. Every day he was looking for ways to make money, and he was very good at it. And he also was very good at spreading the wealth. The secret of his success was he always gave a piece to his to the command structure, whatever precinct he was in, whatever district he was in. He made sure that supervisors, commanders, lieutenants all got a piece of the action. And that's the way it was done more or less back then. It was called the pad. And every precinct had a pad. And what the pad was, it was the sort of system of illegal money being made within the precinct and how that money was spread around within the precinct to people it was supposed to be spread around to. And Phillips was a master at that. And so I would say that in many ways he was typical of the department at that time. He probably was more actively corrupt than your average police officer. But he was not untypical of the system. And the problem was that this type of corruption had become so deeply ingrained in the NYPD at that time that it had created a strong system of code of silence, you know, that made it impossible, everyone thought, for this corruption to be exposed. And the other thing that's important about the Phillips story is it shows in many ways in which the corruption was tied into the racism within the police department and also within the society at large, because a lot of this corruption was taking place in the minority communities. You know, you would allow racketeering, you would allow narcotics and gambling and numbers running and prostitution to take place in the ghetto neighborhoods because those are the blacks. And the cops, quite frankly, didn't give a damn about the black neighborhoods. They didn't identify with the black neighborhoods at all. They saw it as something to be plundered, you know. And so they would allow criminal activity to take place in the minority neighborhoods as a way of making money, as a cynical way of making money, and also a cynical way of controlling the criminal activity to an extent that was taking place within these communities. So that the corruption that had grown up over the decades was very deeply connected to the racial attitudes. And this was the rot. This was the moral rot that was at the core of the relationship between the law enforcement and the black community in the city. And this was the tinderbox that, you know, had been festering for years and was bound to explode, and did explode in a kind of a series of riots and shootings and a whole series of incidents that I detail in the book that take place over this 10-year period.
And in the connection between the corruption and the racism, you mentioned before the code of silence. I mean, that was drawn around both issues, police brutality and corruption.
Yeah, well, the brutality and corruption are usually connected. You know, there's a way that corruption is enforced, and it's enforced through threat of physical intimidation. That's just the law of the streets, the law of the jungle, particularly back in these years of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That relationship was very deeply ingrained in the attitudes and behavior of the police in the city. And, you know, I go to great lengths to detail that, and I try to do it with some sensitivity, because I do think that part of what was happening here is the transformation that was taking place in the city was quite shocking. I mentioned in the book one neighborhood in Brooklyn, the neighborhood of East New York, which was way out on the outskirts of Brooklyn. In a five-year period from 63 to 68, that neighborhood goes from being 80% white, mostly Jewish, Italian, and Irish, to being 80% black and Latino. In a five-year period, that's a pretty staggering demographic transformation. And a process like that is often violent in many different ways. It's just, it's kind of wrenching to everyone involved, and it's ugly, and it was ugly and difficult. There was no social planning for that transformation that took place. And so you had a lot of fear. The guiding principle there was fear. Now, the white people that fled from the neighborhood out of fear, you can say it was racism. And, of course, to a large extent, there was racism. But there was also somewhat of just a genuine fear of feeling under siege from the unknown. You know, obviously impoverished people that were coming in huge numbers that were having a dramatic effect on the neighborhood and creating a level of fear among people in the neighborhood that the city wasn't quite capable of handling. And so the population, the white population, turned to the police department. And I even had an old-time cop who I interviewed tell me, he said, you'd have an old Irish grandmother or an old Italian grandmother come up to you and say, you know, you got to save us. You got to help us save the block because we're going to be overrun. And now a lot of cops took that to heart. Maybe it was racism, but it was also a sort of genuine concern for the longstanding citizens that had been living in that community for many generations. So it was a somewhat complicated phenomenon, and the police found themselves, through no choice of their own, as sort of being the front lines, on the front lines of this dramatic and violent social transformation that was taking place.
For The Savage City, T.J. English talked to long-retired cops and ex-Black Panthers and found their feelings about the period are still raw.
The emotional content was very present because this era was never really resolved and honestly discussed and debated, and so it's still very raw. I think it's raw to the society in general, but it's particularly raw for those people who lived through it.
T.J. English, talking about his new book, out this week. It's The Savage City. We'll talk more after a break. Stay tuned.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with Irish-American author T.J. English talking about his new book, The Savage City, Race, Murder, and a Generation on the Edge. It's about a decade of violence, corruption, and revolt in New York City from the early 60s to the 70s, and focuses on the stories of three real-life figures, George Whitmore, an innocent young black man framed for murder, Bill Phillips, a corrupt cop who turned state's evidence for the Knapp Commission, and Daruba bin Wahad, a black liberationist who became one of the Panther 21. Let's talk now about the rise of the Black Liberation Movement, because that's the third leg of the story. It's a fascinating one. It's one that very much came about in response to the brutality on the part of the police that you talk about in the book.
Yes. One of the things I hope is revelatory in the book is, you know, you begin with the Whitmore, George Whitmore being framed quite sadistically, in a quite sadistic manner, for these crimes he didn't commit. And I would suggest, and I do suggest in the book, that what happens to George Whitmore, I believe I described that chapter as business as usual, that the concept of bringing a young black kid into a back room of a precinct and getting him to confess to a crime he didn't do was not uncommon at all in the city of the 50s and early 60s. And this is true probably of most big cities in the United States. It's just the way that white police, overwhelmingly white police forces, dealt with the black population in the city. Where they went wrong with Whitmore, obviously, is they framed him for a really sensationalistic murder that brought down a level of attention that police didn't normally get. I mean, he was framed in a precinct way out in Brooklyn where stuff never even hardly makes the newspapers, you know? And so they get away with whatever they want to out there pretty much and never have to worry about any kind of scrutiny. What they screwed up is they framed him for, you know, one of the most notorious murders in the city at the time, and so it brought down a level of attention that quickly exposed the fact that his confession was a fraud. If he had just been framed for the murder of some black woman out in Brooklyn, never would have made the newspapers. He would have copped to a plea and he would have gone off to jail. So what you see is the business as usual. This was quite a common way that poor black suspects were dealt with. And so, you know, when you see it, it kind of makes your blood boil. It makes you angry. It should make you angry. And so that you see that what comes next, which is a kind of angry, militant black liberation movement, regardless of how you feel about whether or not those attitudes and the, you know, were right or wrong, you can see the justification for it. You can see where it came from. You can see what that was about. You can see that that was a generation mostly of young black men and women saying, we are not going to take business as usual anymore. We are going to be the first generation that's going to stand up to this kind of behavior, and we're going to fight back. And we're going to fight back with weapons. A lot of this philosophy was rooted in the rhetoric of Malcolm X, who, you know, was in many ways just as much as Martin Luther King Jr. was the godfather of the modern civil rights movement. Malcolm X was the godfather of the black liberation movement. You know, the civil rights movement was all about equality and integration. Well, the black liberation movement was more about asserting black identity, you know, having the right to assert our identity as African Americans in the United States of America. And so the Black Panther Party was born. You know, the Black Panther Party began way out in Oakland, California, around 66 and 67. But it obviously was a movement. It was a very much a grassroots movement whose time had come, because it grew in leaps and bounds in a very short period of time. And the real motivating event that got that movement going was the assassination of Martin Luther King, because Martin Luther King had preached nonviolence. He was taken out in very dramatically violent fashion, and all these young kids said to each other and to themselves, well, if they'll kill him, a guy who really was not a threat to them, then imagine, you know, what they'll do to the rest of us. And it became the justification for a much more militant point of view and starting in late 68, boy, the Black Panther Party just started cropping up in cities all over the United States, not just the big cities like New York and Los Angeles and Philadelphia and Chicago, but even smaller cities like Milwaukee and Seattle and St. Louis. A whole generation of young, and I mean 18, 19, 20-year-old African-American youth rallied to this movement. And again, regardless of how you might feel about the nuts and bolts of what they were doing, it was quite extraordinary that a whole generation threw themselves into the whirlwind like this. I mean, it was not what you would call a great career move. There was no job in it. There was no money in it.
In fact, many got killed. I was out in Madison, Wisconsin at the time, and we were very active around the murder of Fred Hampton, who was a Black Panther. He came to speak at the University of Wisconsin. I saw him speak, and it was just a couple of months later that he was dead, shot in his bed by the police who had shot through the door.
Well, the reaction on the part of law enforcement to this movement was one of almost a hysterical level of fear and threat, because the Black Panther Party was very open in their, you might say, incendiary rhetoric about police in general. They referred to cops as pigs in the Black Panther newspaper that came out on a weekly basis. There was illustrations of the police as pigs. This movement became an expression of anger towards law enforcement on the part of young Black people. It became an outlet for a level of anger directed at police that had been bubbling for generations and generations. And you know, cops were stunned by, they were stunned by a generation of Black people that talked back to them, basically is what it was. And they reacted with full force, and at all levels of law enforcement, local police, but also at the federal level with the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Hoover was concerned about it. The FBI began a program called COINTELPRO, a counterintelligence program to infiltrate the Black Liberation Movement. They really began all the way back in the early 60s. You know, it's common knowledge now that J. Edgar Hoover had a very strange racial point of view, and Martin Luther King Jr. was designated as the most, quote-unquote, the most dangerous Negro in America in an FBI memo after he gave his I Have a Dream speech. So the FBI was very concerned, and it began their policy and initiative of disinformation and infiltration of the Black Liberation Movement. And with the police, it was more of just street-level harassment and hostility, rounding up Panthers. But it, you know, yeah, it got real violent. Panthers were getting killed. You mentioned Fred Hampton in Chicago. He got blown away. It was basically a police execution. It was later more or less proven to be as such. No, young Black youth who chose this route for themselves did so knowing that it could quite possibly end up with prison or death. And yet many of them were willing to do it. Again, regardless of how you feel about the philosophy, you have to tip your cap to the courage, the level of commitment, which is something you can't even dream of young people having that kind of commitment and initiative in this day and age.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with T.J. English about his latest book, just released this week of March 15th, The Savage City. So let's talk about that one particular young man who became a leader of the Black Panther Party. And now, am I pronouncing his name correctly, Daruba Bin Wahad?
Sure.
Okay. So tell us about him, how he started and how he got into it, and then the role that he ultimately took in the Black Panther Party in New York. He was a member of the Panther 21.
Yes, Daruba is a fascinating character, you know, a child of the Bronx. Grew up in the Bronx in the late 50s and kind of became part of a very vibrant gang culture that existed, particularly in the Bronx, but all over the boroughs of New York in the late 1950s. He was a member of a gang called the Sportsman Disciples, the youth division of the Disciples, which was a citywide Black gang in the 1950s. Gangs back then were not quite as violent as what you might think of. We think of gangs today. We think of the post-narcotics era of the Crips and the Bloods and, you know, Uzi submachine guns and all that kind of thing. Back in the 50s, gangs were more like boys' clubs. Yeah, they did have kind of a rough and tumble element to it. But the most violent weapon they would have maybe would be a knife or a zip gun. A zip gun was kind of a homemade gun that could be manufactured out of rubber bands and a few other things that was prevalent back in the late 50s. Daruba got involved in that culture and wound up going off to prison. He was involved in an assault charge when he was 19. And so he went off to prison for 5 years. And when I begin the book, he's in the system. He's in the prison system, which was a good place to start with Daruba's story, because a lot of the black liberation movement is connected to the prisons. You know, Malcolm X came out of the prisons, and the radical Muslim movement in the United States started in the prison system. And, you know, prisons for a lot of young black males became a kind of metaphor for the way they felt they were being treated by the United States social system in general. So you see in the book, you see the way that Daruba is somewhat radicalized in prison. He begins this process of self-education, reading. There's a lot of reading of political philosophy and a lot of reading of history. So that when he comes out of prison in 1967, right into the middle of this cauldron of racial activity that's taking place, he comes right into the middle of this period where the civil rights movement is morphing into the black liberation movement, and he's really primed for it. You know, he's got this political philosophy of Karl Marx and everything else that he's been reading while he's in prison. And so he seizes the historical moment and becomes very involved in the Black Panther Party opening up a chapter in New York City. And it winds up being quite an exciting adventure, because the Black Panther Party in New York City booms quickly and in many ways becomes the center of attention, even outstrips the what they call the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, which is in Oakland, California. That's where Huey P. Newton began the Black Panther Party, was in and Bobby Seale in Oakland. So now the New York branch becomes hugely popular and becomes directly into contact with the NYPD. And so the conflict between the Panthers and the NYPD is detailed in quite a bit of detail in the book. But also that the Panthers in New York kind of clash with the West Coast Panthers. So you are seeing this level of hostility between the East Coast and the West Coast Panthers also develop. And the FBI was very astute and shrewd at using that as a way to bring down the Black Panther Party. They created a whole disinformation campaign to turn the Black Panther Party on the East Coast against the Black Panther on the Panther Party on the West Coast. And they did it with informants and snitches and all that. And they were ultimately very successful at it. So the Daruba storyline sort of takes over in the second part of the book because of all these kind of swirling events that start to take place involving the Black Liberation Movement versus the cops, but also Black Liberation Movement versus the Black Liberation Movement, the internal dissension.
So who were the Panther 21? How did that happen?
That was a huge case at its time. The District Attorney's Office in New York City and the NYPD were concerned about the sudden development and growth of the Black Panther Party in New York City, and were, as I mentioned, I used the word hysterical about it. And they had a number of informants, a total of 4 or 5 different informants working within the Black Panther Party. And so they built a case, a huge conspiracy case. And on one night in early June of 1968, they rounded up a bunch of Panthers in a series of early morning arrests all over the city. They rounded up 21 of them. And brought him in and charged him on a massive 200-count conspiracy indictment, which was basically all about the Black Panther Party's efforts to overthrow the United States government. They rounded up literature in the homes. They grabbed posters of Malcolm X, anything that had a militant political content became part of the conspiracy. And it was a huge case involving a bunch of young lawyers that got involved in the case. And, you know, the Manhattan DA bit off more than they could chew. And the case just kind of dragged on and became bigger and bigger and more unwieldy. And it eventually lasted 2 years. It was the longest running criminal proceeding in the history of the state of New York up to that point. And it became almost kind of a – it became one of those iconic events of this era, you know, much like certain – the March on Washington in 69, the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial in Chicago in 68. The Panther 21 case was one of these cases that sort of brought everyone's attention on the politics and the racial politics of the era. And in fact, by the time it was over, after 2 years, the jury deliberated for 90 minutes, an hour and a half, and found the Panthers not guilty on all charges. So that's what a misguided prosecution, a costly and misguided prosecution that it turned out to be. But in some ways, it was successful because it decimated the Black Panther Party. It successfully decimated the Black Panther Party in New York City. It more or less crushed the Black Panther Party in New York City. So if that was the intention, and I'm sure it was partly part of the intention, then they were successful. But as a prosecutorial move, it was a huge failure on the part of the Manhattan DA.
And finally, T.J. English, you say on the cover of the book that this was a challenge to write, that facts are fungible. You say a lot of people had different interpretations, the facts were different to different people. Tell us a little bit more about that, and how did you kind of wind your way through the thicket here?
Yeah, well, it was very true that the emotion, you know, if you're going to interview, let's say, retired cops who worked during these years and were involved in some of the events I described, and then you're going to interview Black Panthers, people who were involved in the Black Liberation Movement, you know, you're going to get drastically different takes on the same events. And mostly, not so much of the details. You know, you can go to newspaper accounts and get facts and figures and details about things. But the emotional content of it was so strong. Both sides felt so misunderstood. Both sides felt wronged to the point where they were willing to take extreme actions. And by extreme actions, I mean violations of the law, violence, killing. This happened on both sides. You know, that's how extreme this hostility became. You're going to get people that go into a kind of self-justification mode. They have to see it a certain way because it justifies certain actions they might have taken. And you're lucky if you come across sources who are able to sort of step back and see their own part of it within the larger historical framework. But generally speaking, when you're interviewing participants, you get the view of a participant. You get their particular point of view. And I try to include that in the narrative of the book. I think that it's possible to read the book, which is told from the point of view of these three quite different characters. And I hope that when you're reading it from these different points of view, you're kind of seeing it through the eyes and feeling it and experiencing it through the eyes of those particular characters who are living it. So whatever judgment you make or whatever conclusion you reach, it will be not only based on the concrete factual information that's in the book, but also on some connection or feeling of connection to the humanity of the characters in the story. Because what's extraordinary to me about this story is we're talking about a kind of everyday life that existed at this time, and yet it reads kind of like a war saga. You know, it reads almost as if you're describing like different battles in a war that took place in some foreign land, but it wasn't. It was right here in a major American metropolis, major American city. And as I mentioned before, there were versions of this story in New York taking place in pretty much every big city in the United States at the time. And these feelings of this era and these events were playing out on almost a daily basis within the lives of the characters and within the lives of the communities in which these events were taking place. And so that's part of it, to feel some connection to the humanity of it, to not maybe focus so much on the factual detail of it, but to get a sense of what the characters were feeling. And then I think maybe even today, 45 years later, you can feel the story. As much as understand it and grasp it intellectually, you can feel the emotional content of it.
We're talking with journalist and author T.J. English about his book, The Savage City. It's out this week from HarperCollins. And this is the third or maybe fourth book that you've written about kind of the, not the hoi polloi of New York, not the uppity-ups, but the working class, where things are difficult, the gritty city. What draws you so much to this subject?
Yeah, I do tend to get bored if I get too far away from the if I get very far away from the street level. Just because that's where a lot of the drama is, and that's where you get human beings interacting in a less calculated way. You get a kind of maybe more immediate and honest level of interaction and communication, you know, where people express their anger and love in ways that are more direct. And I do deal a lot with human beings in relation to the social system that they're living in, whether they're doing it as criminals. I write about criminals a lot. And in some ways, although this is not a book about organized crime or criminals, it felt like it a little bit, because the Black Panther Party, of course, existed as almost kind of an underground movement and were treated like criminals by the police and were pursued by the police as such. And so you get a very similar narrative thread, which is people who find themselves on, quote unquote, the wrong side of the law for whatever reason, and all the reasons why they do wind up on the wrong side of the law, which, you know, sometimes is just simply because they committed a crime. But a lot of times it's a circumstance of birth. It's a circumstance of social class. It's a circumstance of race and skin color and immigration and where you fit on the economic ladder, you know, where your economic status is in relation to the system at large. So that phenomenon of the basic citizen's relation to the social system is what really fascinates me the most. And the closer you can get that to just kind of real basic street level, then the more interesting and exciting it is to me. Maybe that comes from having driven a cab for a few years when I was working as a freelance journalist in the 80s. I drove a taxi for 3 years in New York. And I'm very glad to not be doing that now. But I do think in many ways it was a formative thing to have done. It gave me a certain relationship to the street-level world around me, you know. And so I find myself thinking about that role, the role of being a cab driver, at least metaphorically speaking. It seems very similar to what I do now as a writer. So maybe there's some connection there.
Similar to what you do as a writer?
Yeah, well, similar to the point of view that I've adopted as a writer, how I see the city. And with cab driving, it's quite literally how you see the city, the street activity in the city at all hours of the night, in all different neighborhoods from different economic strata. See the way that police interact in the city. You see a lot of things driving a taxi that you don't see otherwise. And so you develop a point of view, I think, about the street life of a city that you wouldn't get otherwise. And so I'm always kind of hyper aware. I know for a fact that it probably had a lot to do with giving me certain skills for gathering, going out into the world and gathering the material to write these kind of books, relating to people, talking to people, being able to go into certain situations where I might not have necessarily had the street smarts to do that before. So I think about it a lot, and I like to think that cab driving is kind of a metaphor for what I do, but maybe I'm the only one who thinks that.
The book is The Savage City, Race, Murder, and a Generation on the Edge. It is a terrific read. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
TJ English. You can hear the interview he gave us 2 years ago about his book Havana Nocturne at writersvoice.net. And if you missed any portion of this show, go to our website to hear it again. And in honor of St. Patrick's Day, we'll play a recording of Seamus Heaney reading his poem, Bogland. But first, here's something about the poet from the BBC's poetry website. Ireland's most celebrated living poet, Heaney was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1995, quote, for works of lyrical beauty and ethical depth, which exalt everyday miracles and the living past. Seamus Heaney was born in County Derry, Northern Ireland, in 1939. At the age of 12, he won a scholarship to a Catholic boarding school, and it was there he received news of the death of his young brother, an incident remembered in his poems The Blackbird of Glanmore and Midterm Break. Quote, a four-foot box, a foot for every year. Heaney went on to study English at Queen's University Belfast before training as a teacher. Heaney's first book, Death of a Naturalist, 1966, contained rich depictions of his rural upbringing. But by the 1970s, as Ireland's troubles increased, his work took a more political turn. Heaney's poems are often triggered by small, intimate memories. The shipping forecast typifies his love of place names and joy of the sound of words. Fascinated by folklore, he also published an award-winning translation of Beowulf.
Bogland. We have no prairies to slice a big sun at evening. Everywhere the eye concedes to encroaching horizon is wooed into the cyclops' eye of a tarn. Our unfenced country is bog that keeps crusting between the sights of the sun. They've taken the skeleton of the great Irish elk out of the peat, set it up an astounding crate full of air. Butter sunk under more than 100 years was recovered, salty and white. The ground itself is kind black butter, melting and opening underfoot, missing its last definition by millions of years. They'll never dig coal here, only the waterlogged trunks of great firs, soft as pulp. Our pioneers keep striking inwards and downwards. Every layer they strip seems camped on before. The bog holes might be Atlantic seepage. The wet center is bottomless.
Seamus Heaney reading his poem, Bogland. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.